Good morning. How lovely to see you. Back here again. I know you woke up this morning and you thought, I want to hear about the harmony of difference and sameness. And you just popped right out of bed. You're like, this is going to be great. So I'm going to talk about this poem today, which is called The Harmony of Difference and Sameness. It's an old poem written by a fellow named Chouteau, you know. Sometimes when I search for Chouteau, it's S-H-I-T-O-U, and I actually get blanked out because they think I'm searching for something bad. That has absolutely happened to me. Anyway, he's one of the great ancestors of our traditions. He wrote another poem called The Song of the Grassroof Hermitage. But this poem I'm going to talk about today is his more famous and influential work, and this piece of literature is chanted in Soto Zen centers all over the world on a regular basis. And guess what? That means I think it would be nice for us to chant it here today. And the other thing I knew that got you out of the bed this morning was you thought, I want to do some chanting. Yes. Now, if you're not real familiar with Zen chanting, I think you'll be able to figure out how it works pretty fast. It's a very simple thing. But like all Zen practice, it's really infinitely rich. So we have the opportunity when we're chanting to do something together, although you can also chant alone. I do chanting practice, usually 10 or 15 minutes a day on my own. But here we'll do it together, which is the way it's most commonly done. So it's about doing something together with your bodies, which is most of what our practice is about. It's about doing something together with your bodies. I'm going to say a lot of words in the next 35 minutes, but that's like a little corner of what Zen practice is about. So, and then what we do is you can produce sound. How wonderful is that after a half an hour of silence, quiet? And you can listen. Listening is really important if you want to chant. Actually, if you want to make any kind of sound, I encourage a lot of listening. Your conversations will improve when you're making those sounds with your mouth. Listening is good. Receptivity and offering. And you might also have the experience of being like, this is super weird. How cool! If you have that experience, it's like you got to come somewhere and experience something that felt really weird to you. That's very good for us. Life gets very stultified if there's not enough. What is this? What is this? It's really good for us. As we chant this piece of literature, the opening lines are, the mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. I just like to point out that it's intimate transmission. This is central to our tradition. It's the opening line of multiple, it's in the opening lines of multiple central texts. Intimate encounter. So we can actually encounter each other just through the sounds of our shared voices, through the way we move through the space together, and through conversation. But also through just like sitting still together. There's a deep intimacy there. The last thing I'll say is, as we're chanting this little piece of literature, you might be like, what the heck is this about? Because it doesn't make any sense. That's quite possible. Literature that's 1,000 years old from any culture is likely to be pretty baffling to most people. So we just start there. And then Zen is not, it doesn't really have a reputation for being designed to be accessible on first blush. So if you find yourself just like, what is this? That's okay. You can just hear the sound that we're making, feel your body making sounds. It's cool. It is possible that something in the poem will make sense to you. And that's cool too. That's fine. It might be something inspiring. That's pretty good. I need a little inspiration. Sometimes I'm like, this world is so messed up, I'm just going to lie down. And I think that we need to keep standing up. I think that. So sometimes we need some inspiration. Anyway, so the poem is located in these chant books, and look, there they are. I wonder if people near the radiators could begin to distribute chant books to people just by passing them down the line. There may not be enough for one for everyone, so some of you might end up sharing. That is fine. If you get your chant book, the harmony of difference and sameness is located on the fourth leaf from the back of the book, on the back side of it. It's page number 5.8. Blessings to Daishin and Rosemary for numbering these pages. That's a big project. Anyway, yeah, so if you go to the back, flip through four pages, look at the back side, you'll see harmony of difference and sameness. So if you've never done this before, you can just kind of see what happens. Feel free to join in when you know what's the deal.
Harmony of difference and sameness. The mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. While human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. The spiritual source shines clear in the light. The branching streams flow on in the dark. Grasping at things is surely delusion. According with sameness is still not enlightenment. All the objects of the senses interact and yet do not. Interacting brings involvement, otherwise each keeps its place. Sights vary in quality and form. Sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. Refined in common speech come together in the dark. Clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. The four elements return to their natures just as a child turned to its mother. Fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid, eye and sights, ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and tastes. Thus with each and everything, depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth, trunk and branches share the essence, revere. Brahman each has its speech. In the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and dark oppose one another like the front and back foot in walking. Each of the myriad things has its merit expressed according to function and place. Phenomena exist, box and lid fit, principle responds, arrow points meet. Hearing the words, understand the meaning. Don't set up standards of your own. If you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? Progress is not a matter of far or near, but if you are confused, mountains and rivers block your way. I respectfully urge you who study the mystery, do not pass your days and nights in vain.
Oh, sounds good. Thank you for sharing your voice. So the main theme of this poem is this relationship between difference and sameness, light and dark, absolute and relative, principle and phenomena. They use a lot of different ways to talk about some similar ideas. You can just hear in the language of it, he says at some point, the light, things are clear in the light, they flow in the dark, they come together in the dark and are distinguished in the light. In the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. So there's all these images, and there's some complexly embedded things, like in the last line it says, do not pass your days and nights in vain. And actually, Well, let me come back to that in a minute. I have to explain something else or talk about something else here. So what is generally being talked about here, I'll start talking from like the Mahayana Buddhist perspective. That's kind of like the underpinning for what we do around here. So light is like what it is like for us. Things look like they're illuminated by something, and then they're all distinct. So there's like all different people, and the floor is different than the ceiling. And the light is just a metaphor, so this includes all of our senses. It sounds like there's a little... Somebody is chattering out there. I don't know if you can hear that. Maybe you can't hear that over there. There's a little being telling us something, or telling somebody something, out the window. All that is like distinct things that are manifesting in the moment. So that's like the light, is this... We experience the world as revealed as a bunch of distinct things all shown. Now the dark is ain't none of that. That's basically what the dark is. Nothing is distinguished. Nothing is separate. Nothing is alienated from anything else. So, like, we usually experience life, I think, at least I do and most people I know do, we think that the world is actually made up of a bunch of distinct, separate things that bump up against each other and are sometimes aggravating or sometimes to be desired, frequently to be ignored or manipulated. So, you know, you got someone in your family, you don't want to just, like, not pay attention or get them to do what you want them to. Or maybe there's something in the wider world of human behavior that you kind of think should just go a very particular way and you've got it figured out. So this is the light is the experience of the light is that it looks like everything's lit up, separate, and cut off. And this applies to everything that's experienced. So it's not, I start by talking about like the phenomena of the moment and then like how we look at the world, but it's also anything that is internal to ourselves. Once we look at it, it's become an object of consciousness, so our consciousness is shining the light on it, and it looks like a distinct, separate thing. And that's how you can be sitting here being like, I want to get rid of this feeling, or I want to get rid of this part of me. This part of me is to be ignored. This part of me is to be manipulated. This part is to be cut off. So all this way of experiencing life is being described here as the light. It's the light. What's in the light? But the dark is that none of that is ultimately true. So like using the normal language of Buddhism, when I'm talking about all these distinct things in the light, that's the relative nature. And then the absolute nature is that none of that is really true. Your mind just made everything look distinct. But ultimately, it's all just co-evolving. That's how the universe works. It co-evolves, and then we don't believe that. And then we go, ow! Because everything seems to be... not going, you know, you want to manipulate it, but it doesn't really work. So the other, you know, there's other language, like if you were in my talk a couple weeks ago, I talked about the three natures. So here, the light basically corresponds to the imaginary nature of things, and the dark corresponds to the complete realized nature of things. Those are two of the poles. You may not remember that, that's fine. So this is basically what's being talked about. So normally, in case it's not evident, what we only experience the world as the light. We don't even know the dark is there. We don't have any contact with the fact that all of the things we believe are real are illusions. Most of us don't have much contact with that, especially on an experiential level. Just meeting the world is already complete, whole, and exactly as it is, without any need to judge, fix, control, or delineate. So anyway, this is like a really underpinning of how Mahayana Buddhism views the world, is that maybe we need to get more in balance and be able to access the dark or the absolute and realize that everything is co-evolving completely as it is and is beyond our control. Which doesn't mean we don't have agency. So if that's confusing, go back and listen to the talk from 2 weeks ago where I talked about that part a lot more. That is a difficult concept. It's not my fault. I didn't make it up. So anyway, we have this underpinning, this absolute relative, complete, or imaginary versus realization, or light and dark binaries. And that's in Mahayana Buddhism, which comes from India, and came to China And China already had a long-standing indigenous tradition called Taoism, where they had this idea of yin and yang. And yin is described as light, and yang is dark. And yin is delineated, distinct phenomena. It's active. And the yang is mysterious, dark, unknown, unseparate. So I don't know if this seems clear why someone might go, these concepts look pretty similar. This yin-yang thing and this absolute relative thing. They are not identical by any stretch of the imagination, but they did become melded within the Zen tradition. So many people would say that Zen is basically a merging of Buddhism and Taoism. And this poem is about as much of a merging of Buddhism and Taoism as you are likely to find, because all this language from Taoism of light and dark is brought in. So, I'm starting this talk on the nerdy side with all this like real, you know, nerdy stuff, and it will be less nerdy later, hopefully. I don't know if I'm really capable of that as a human being, but never mind. So, one of the other things about this piece of literature is the depth, the unbelievable depth of allusiveness, symbolism that is contained within it. So sometimes a single character will have all these different valences referring to whole different, like Taoism, Buddhism, different strains of Buddhism. And this is pretty common. Early Zen literature is incredibly compact. You'll have like a really important teaching is like two sentences. You know, and then you go to Indian Mahayana and it's like a really important teaching. It's like 1,200 pages. So it's just a different style. But that funny thing is when I first came to Zen, there was all this talk about, all we're trying to do here is step into unmediated experience and really realize something beyond all our conceptions and ideas and linguistically conditioned patterns and just meet life whole as it is. Listen, the dark, right? Not the light, the dark. And then I started like reading the literature, and it was like, in order to understand it, there'd be like 17 things that were referred to just in one word. And I was like, well, that's, how am I going beyond language using all these words? And this is where this poem comes into mind, because in the light there's darkness, but don't take it as darkness. We can make a binary and look at them as separate, but ultimately they're not. And actually we can use language to transcend language. So just to give you a few examples in this poem, like at the beginning of the poem it says there are no northern or southern ancestors. So the north side of a mountain is the dark side in China, because the sun is in the south. So the north side is the yang. The south is the yin. Later on, it refers to mountains and rivers. The top of a mountain is where the light is. Yin, that's the light. The valley where the river is the yang. This is why Dogen keeps saying, practice in the valley bottom. Go down into the dark beyond what you know. Go somewhere mysterious. Maybe a little scary. I always want to go to the top of a mountain. That's my problem. But I'm not alone. In the last line of the poem, it says, do not pass your days and nights in vain. That's our translation. The two characters at the beginning of the line that are translated as days and nights, the most direct translation would be light and yang. So the thing they translate as night doesn't even usually get used to mean night in most contexts. It only means yang, like yin yang, and light is light. So like that one line, you could write a book. Maybe I will. About that one line. It's very rich. It's very rich. So, yes, I understand this. Well, did I come here to have a discourse on how to study Chinese literature? I don't know. Is that why you got out of bed? Because you wanted to chant? I was right about that. But anyway, this is about our experience. So, generally speaking, in Mahayana literature, when we talk about the light and the dark, it's like the light gets kind of put down, the relative is put down, we're stuck there, we're always stuck thinking everything's separate and feeling like we're trying to like grab a hold of things and get rid of things, and what we need to do is realize their unlimitedness and being beyond what we know and let go. Cool. But this poem kind of offers something different. Because the vision of the light it presents, it says, eye and sights, ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and tastes. Thus, with each and everything, the leaves spread forth. I mean, it's like, this is cool. In the light, there's all these phenomena. You have a body. You see things. So I remember I literally remember the first time I heard this poem, because we used to chant it in the mornings after morning zazen. So in the mornings here, every day, except Sundays, we chant the Heart Sutra after zazen. And so I've chanted that thing oh so many times. And but we did that all the time, and I've done it a bunch of times, and maybe you don't know it. It goes, there are no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind. Dark is inviting you into the dark. All those things that you think are discrete phenomena are actually part of an undivided whole. Can you let go and open up? So I heard that, and I was like, oh, this is weird. This is weird, but I just chanting, you know, because I felt something here. And then one day they're like, started this chant. And it gets to the part where it says, eye and sights, ear and sounds, nose and smells. And I was like, yeah, there are. The Heart Sutra is true, and this is true too. And I realize, like, when I do this practice, my senses come alive. If you haven't done this practice of sitting zazen enough to find that a leaf is suddenly like way more than a leaf ever was to you, please just sit some more. Come in here and sit with us. The sensory world becomes so complete, and it's still distinct. So the light is amazing. But the only reason the light has gained this amazingness is because we've started to open up to the dark. By sitting on that cushion and letting go of trying to control anything about ourselves or any other phenomena. And just having maybe one moment where we're actually just with everything. And then the light, it changes in relationship to this experience of the dark. So this poem goes on, and that's my little discourse on the principal theme of the poem. Now, the poem, I could talk about this for a long time. That's probably evident. But so I'm not going to give you like a comprehensive, like we're going to go down and go through the whole thing. I've just picked a few things out thematically that I thought would be valuable. So there's a couple lines in here that say, grasping at things is surely delusion. According with sameness is still not enlightenment. Grasping at things is surely delusion. According with sameness is still not enlightenment. So this really is connected to what I was talking about at my last Dharma talk. So the basic idea that everything is connected and that there's this darkness is that there aren't actually separate things. There aren't separate things, so there's nothing that can be grasped. The idea that you can control anything is always an illusion constructed by your mind. The impact of what you do is always unlimited. So you think, because you did this thing, that was, I controlled that and it's done. But the doneness never happens because you're ignoring all the other parts of your impact. So grasping at things is surely delusion, because we think, oh, I'll just get that and then I'll be happy. Have you ever had that experience? Has it ever turned out that it really lasted? And it doesn't say grasping things, because it doesn't even suggest that you can actually grasp anything. You're just grasping at them. I'm just grasping at them. And you might think, ah, come on, man. It's totally evident that I actually grasp and get things. And that's true. You know, the light is affirmed. It's true. But it's also not true. You might be like, I'm not coming. I don't need to do this Buddhism thing. It's all about suffering. And I got it. I'm good. I got a good job. I'm making the money. I got a sense of purpose. I got the people I want in my life. I'm totally calm. I'm sure you're all like this. And so, like, you're like, why bother? Well, this isn't true. I have successfully grasped everything. That's not delusive. It feels good. That will end. Two, it's already over. There are billions of people who are not experiencing that. How narrow is it to sit and exist within this little sense of security and I'm okay by having to cut yourself off from the whole world of humanity? How small is that for us? We can't understand how much pain we incur and experience because of that. But this tradition says we can crack through to something way bigger, way more free. So grasping at things is surely delusion. So if you're like me, you're like, well, dang, no problem. All I got to do is stop grasping, and we're all set. Oh, man. Zen doesn't make it easy. Grasping at things is surely delusion. According with sameness is still not enlightenment. So you're like, oh, I'll let go of, you know, all this light and having everything feel distinct and separate and graspable, and I'll step into some total whole. I'll meet the darkness in Zazen during Rohatsu session on day 6. Right there in front of my teacher during Dokusan. Total realization, just like in the book. And then, boom! According with sameness is still not enlightenment. He's not going to tell you what enlightenment is. And it's kind of weird because the whole thing is the darkness is better than the light? I don't know. Anyway, you might be like, well, that's a drag. I wanted to be able to grasp enlightenment. I wanted to turn it into a thing and I'd finally get the darkness and then I'd be all set. I understand that because I feel that way. But this presents something way more beautiful and open. An infinite process of a rolling ball of transformation and liberation. I talk to people, and I have been a person who encounter, you know, they're like, you talk to someone who's like really deeply from a monotheistic tradition, they might just be like, well, he's up there. I don't know why it's always a he. It's not always a he. It's often a he. He's up there, and he got it all figured out. And I just have given everything up, and I have total security. And I'm like jealous. That sounds so good. And so, you know, people will come to me in Dokusan and be like, man, this Zen is kind of a drag. I want that rock-solid security. And it we give you a different kind of security in this tradition. It's an affective security and a security that's based on your ability to actually flow with the fact that life always changes. It's not an ideological faith. It's an embodied faith. So anyway, I am going to talk to you a little bit about someone named Bell Hooks. Bell Hooks is she's a longtime student of Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese Zen master. And she's a very prolific author. She's been around for, she started writing, I think, in the late 60s. But she's written about 30 books. And she's really closely associated with the intersectional feminist movement. Anyway, she's quite wonderful. And I found this right this week. I was like, what am I going to do? And then I found this, how am I going to talk about this poem? I found this passage on an interview. She did an interview with George Yancey, who's a great philosopher who writes for the New York Times. He interviewed her, and I read the interview, and I found this passage that I thought spoke to what we're talking about here. So what I want to say is just a quotation from her from the interview. The second word is militant. And I just want to be clear about Bell Hooks' use of the word militant. So I'll quote from another passage of Bell Hooks where she says, the most militant, radical intervention anyone can make is to engage in the practice of love. So when we're talking about militant here, you don't need any weapons. You can put them all down. Love isn't a weapon. So anyway, she says, my militant commitment to feminism remains strong. And the main reason is that feminism has been the contemporary social movement that has most embraced self-interrogation. When we, women of color, for Bell Hooks is a black woman, when we, women of color, began to tell white women that females were not a homogenous group, that we had to face the reality of racial difference, many white women stepped up to the plate. I'm a feminist in solidarity with white women today for that reason. Because I saw these women grow in their willingness to open their minds and change the whole direction of feminist thought, writing, and action. This continues to be one of the most remarkable, awesome aspects of the contemporary feminist movement. So what I was talking about is according with sameness is still not enlightenment. So a lot of people kind of want to just get everything down to one. You ever heard people talk about, like, oh, I'm just going to realize oneness? Well, oneness is a problem because people get left out of one all the time. So if you just say, oh, yeah, we're all just one, someone might be like, yes, I actually feel separate. That is to be recognized because it's their experience. It's part of this process. So there's this really great documentary called She's Beautiful When She's Angry. Looks like no one's seen it. Well, you don't have to, but you can. It's pretty good. It is a documentary about second wave feminism, so it's mostly about 60s and 70s, and it's mostly talking head interviews with women who are involved in the movement. And it's quite wonderful, I think. And you start out, and it's kind of like the formation of the movement, and it's like there's some white women are talking. And then someone comes on, and they're like, yeah, well, I'm a lesbian, and I want to be a part of the movement. But I was like, wow, it's really, I have a lot of problems because I'm lesbian. We really should remember how much progress has made around LGBT issues in the last 40 years. It's mind-boggling. But anyway, they come in, and the women in the feminist movement would be like, no, we can't talk about that. That will, yeah, that's, just be a woman. Don't be a lesbian woman, just be a woman. And then they had a lot of conflict, and it was really hard. And then they changed, and they said, hey, we can talk about how you are. And we start to see what we think of as an intersectional movement that honors difference and is like recognizes that people suffer for a variety of reasons. How about that? And then the next thing is you get like this Chicano woman and she's like, wow, well, we showed up and we want to go to the meetings and we're like, you know, we're experiencing all this racism because we are Chicanos and you're not even talking about it and it's part of this process for us. And the people who are at the core of the movement, who are mostly white, were like, yeah, we really can't talk about it. It's a little muddy, our message. And then they had a big fight. And then they changed. And the movement got bigger. And it got bigger by actually including difference. And then it just goes through all these different iterations of that with people who suffered in many different ways. The people in this room suffer in many different ways. You're not going to figure it out by like, oh, we got the one-drop formula. It's a process of meeting and encountering. So, I say this not only because I think it would be great if everyone here really made a commitment to making a world where no one was oppressed by any system. There was no systems that violated and dominated people. I would love it if everyone did that. But it's a Zen talk, so I'm not supposed to be like focusing on that. The point is, this is fundamental to Mahayana Buddhism. The point is to devote yourself to everyone being free from suffering. There's going to be a lot of ways. We got to take care of our hearts when we're uptight because it's like, oh, my tea came back too cold. We got to do that. Because that's the feeling that arose. It's valid. But we also should be listening to the fact that the whole world has all these different ways of experiencing and knowing and feeling and care. And care. So the ball keeps rolling. That's like, to me, that's the underlying message of this poem. It's like, in the light there's darkness, but don't take it as darkness. You think, oh, I got it. I thought they were two, but now they're one. It's like, no, they're not one. This is what's offered to us, to keep opening up, to not let our practice close down. Any binary way of understanding how we're going to fix everything is always going to be too limited. So, towards the end of the poem, There's this line, progress is not a matter of far or near, but if you are confused, mountains and rivers block your way. Oh, man. Have I felt like mountains and rivers block my way before? So I like to spend a lot of time in the mountains. And I lead retreats in the mountains, usually one or two a year, usually like 6 days. And we go into the wilderness and we practice. We practice in silence. We practice meditation. I think it's just a wonderful and powerful thing to do. And the frequency with which I've been somewhere out in the mountains and I've been like, that mountain is in my way. I want to get on the other side of it because when I get on the other side, I can lie down and it's going to be great. So oftentimes, mountains, they're blocking my way. Rivers, you know, it's like, we got to ford this river. And I'm like, where are we going to ford the river? Are we going to get everyone across without anyone swimming? Oh my gosh, it's in my way. But that's just a way of looking at things. In the light, that's what things look like. In the dark, I'm just there in the mountains and it's whole. It's whole. And there's just feet moving. Oh, they're mine. There's breath. Oh, I guess you'd call that mine. Or is it the mountains? It's whole. And nothing's in the way. I'm not waiting to get to the other side or to figure it out. That can happen too. I could be in the river. Just in the river. The cold. The rush. I can even be in the like, I'm afraid I'm going to fall. I can be right in that. Doesn't have to block my way. So, I just want to say also that when I'm out in Montana, I see a lot of discourse and hear a lot of discourse about Lewis and Clark. You know, so Lewis and Clark, kind of an amazing thing. They crossed this huge part of the continent that white people had not crossed. And a famous story of when they got over the first range of mountains, they got over it and they thought they were going to see the Pacific Ocean. And they were like tired. They were like really ready. The mountains had been blocking their way. And they got over and it was like more mountains. They got over those and then it was like a huge high desert and then another mountain range. And I mean, they were discouraged. It was very, very hard. They were blocked. That's how they were looking at it. That's real. But, you know, I hear all that discourse and it's like, you know, the voyage of Lewis and Clark was fundamental to the taking of the land of the indigenous people. That effort had to happen for the land to be taken away. Someone had to be the first white person to go across and prove that it could be done. And, you know, I don't know. I can't speak to how the Blackfeet and the Salish and the Kootenai from the area where I hike were experiencing the mountains and rivers, to what degree they felt like a barrier. I don't know that. But they didn't seem to have the thing, we're always just going to keep pushing and getting and gaining and taking. We can put some of this down. We can put some of it down and settle into something where the mountains aren't in the way. So I just want to end by talking about this line, do not pass your days and nights in vain. I hope that you do not pass your days and nights in vain. I don't think that that will be proved by anything that was controlled or any outcome. We may sort of measure, oh, was my day good or bad? But to not pass your day and night in vain is to pour your energy into the possibility of people being free by seeing what's here, by slowing down, by listening, by caring. Fugan Zazengi, which is Dzogen's central text on how to practice Zazen, the universal recommendation for Zazen, near the end, he says, you have gained the pivotal opportunity of human form. You are taking care of the essential activity of the Buddha way. Do not pass your days and nights in vain. It's a callback. You're taking care of the essential activity of the Buddha way, because that's all life is. How are you taking care of it? The question is the quality of the care. It's not what you're getting out of it. How are you taking care of this moment of what's happening? If you turn your attention towards taking care of what's happening fully, that, in this tradition, is to not pass your days and nights in vain. And somehow that darkness will become more clear, and the light will become more murky, and something more peaceful and more loving will flow out of what would traditionally be called you. Thank you. So I'm going to invite other people to speak. Questions or answers are welcome.
Yeah. Piggybacking on Lewis and Clark, for what it's worth, I was scanning National Geographic this morning. There was an article about the Arctic.
The Arctic?
About the Arctic.
Yeah.
And now that the Arctic is dissipating, or the ice is, what we're all doing as a species is are getting our people up there so that we can get after that stuff as quickly as humanly possible.
Mm.
So there's factions between Russia and China and you name it that feel that the most important thing is to get the best trade routes, the best access to minerals, the best access to petroleum.
So. Mm. Yeah, so when I hear that... Well, you know, when I don't know about you, when you hear that, there's one impulse to just be like, oh, God, what... You know, I'm not at an oil company, but the promise of this tradition is you always have agency. That is the promise of the tradition. It doesn't mean you can control the outcome. You can't change what those other people are doing, but you can make an offering. If you don't know how to make an offering, go to a meeting about how to make an offering. And you might be like, I go to the meetings and I get so tired of talking and talking. But we have to talk. We're humans. It's going to be part of the process. But we can also be quiet and listen to the saw. Really? The planes. This is at the heart of our practice. To take time to just be in our sensory world. This is actually powerful. Oh, I was going to wrap up. I'll do one here.
How do you distinguish the subconscious mind from the dark? Is that what you're talking about?
They're pretty distinct in this frame of thought. So the darkness really is, it's almost metaphysical. It's that things are not separate. It's their inherent not separateness. Because they're all things... are dependent on each other. Like if you just look at dependency, you'll see they're dependent on each other. Because of that, they're not separate. And that is undifferentiated. So if you see that, what you see is not separate things. It's like, so it's described as darkness. The unconscious, from a Buddhist perspective, particularly Yogacara's, it's producing what we see as the light. So our unconscious is actually something we're not aware of that produces all the stuff we think is actually stuff. But it's not actually stuff. It's the darkness. But because we think it's stuff, we got to work with it. So it's not like it doesn't matter, but it can kind of soften our relationship to it. Ha. Okay. So I think that's good for today. I'm very grateful to have had the time to be with you, and I'm grateful for your practice. So thank you all.